Hello, welcome to the second Millennial 2016 Hangout, and this is with Greg Johnson from Countercurrents. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me back.
And Bain DeWitt has joined us.
Well.
Hello, Bain. Don't know what... no, that's okay. All right. Shall we... Okay, so I don't know what we were going to speak about, really, but let's just start with... someone's posted a question. So shall we talk about... okay, let's talk about this year first, 2016. What would you say has happened, the trajectory of the alt-right in this year?
Well, it's been a huge year, and things are going quite well. The Trump campaign and victory, I think, have been very, very good for us in terms of actually advancing things that we value, right? But also because they brought us a huge amount of new visibility. So those are the most important things, really. The Trump campaign, the Trump victory, and then of course all the trends in Europe and the United States that have made Trump necessary are also feeding into our visibility, making us seem more plausible, making us seem like we have a solution. And we do have a solution. We have a description of the problem and an actual solution to it. And so I think that our credibility is just going to keep rising in 2017, and our audiences are going to keep rising. We've had tremendous growth. It really started with the migrant crisis. I started noticing tremendous growth. It continued throughout the entire Trump campaign, and it has continued after Trump's victory. Last month, we were just short of 150,000 unique visitors at Countercurrents. We got to the 100,000 unique visitors mark at the middle of this month. And if things keep going well, we're going to be embarking distance of 200,000 unique visitors at the end of the month. So that's tremendous. There's a lot of growth going on, a lot of interest, and that's just going to keep happening in the new year. And one of the things that's important to understand is that Trump is going to solve certain problems. He's going to put a limit on immigration in America, especially from south of the border, on the Mexican border. And he's also going to try and put an end to Muslim immigration, which are two huge problems. But he's not really one of us, right? Obviously, he's not a racial nationalist. He's a civic nationalist. And civic nationalism is a flawed position. And all the contradictions and problems of civic nationalism are going to persist under his regime. And I think that we will be there to explain why these are problems and point to the necessity of an ethnic nationalist solution.
Well, that seems like a very interesting thing to say. Why is civic nationalism a flawed position?
Well, every society needs a principle of unity. And you will find this in even in multicultural societies, right? They will try and find a principle of unity. Why is that? Well, because you can't really have a working society if it's too heterogeneous. They say that diversity is a strength, but they know for a fact that diversity is not a strength. And therefore, they have to impose a kind of unity on society. And that means that there's really an incompatibility between any form of pluralism or multiculturalism, and even democracy. Even democracies need some kind of unity, right? And so
I would say especially democracies need some kind of unity, because it's not coming from a top.
Right, exactly. There's so much of, you've got to, how to put it, there's got to be a principle of unity in a society, and if the people are making decisions, then the people have to carry that principle with them. It has to be in them. If it's not being imposed by some kind of top-down order. So what civic nationalism basically is, is an attempt to impose a fake or artificial unity on society, on multicultural societies. We see that in France, and we see that in the United States. The French have a strong civic nationalist republican tradition, and anybody's born in France is French. We have the same stupid attitude in the United States. And as the population becomes increasingly heterogeneous, that means that they're going to have to keep doubling down on this civic nationalist ideology of saying that if you're born in France, you're a Frenchman. Since having a common race and a common culture and even a common language don't seem to be defining, or common religion don't seem to be defining principles, they have to make it somehow vague things like a commitment to Republican principles, things like that. A commitment to diversity, which is a commitment to disunity and nothingness, right? This is what they have to try and do. And yet at the same time, on the street, the reality is that increasingly heterogeneous societies are filled with tension and fear, suspicion, lack of trust, and violence, constant violence, sometimes extremely bad violence, civil war type violence, as well as grinding day-to-day petty violence, and then the kind of terrorism that we've been witnessing in Europe and in the United States, unfortunately, but more so in Europe because of the presence of Islam. So the problem with civic nationalism is that the principle of unity that it tries to impose upon a society isn't based on nature. It's purely conventional, and it goes against the reality of the situation. The reality is that the best form of society is one where people are related to one another, right? The best society is an extended family where people have blood ties and where, even on a genetic level, they are in harmony with one another. The great problem of politics is how to harmonize disharmonious people. And there are a lot of people who say, well, if we've got a common culture, that's enough, right? Or a common language. This is what the civic nationalists do in the sort of alt-light sphere, right? We are Western chauvinists, right? Not racists, Western chauvinists. And what is Western? Well, Western values. Well, Blacks and Browns have very different interpretations of Western values than we do. They frankly don't have much use for them. But if you really want to find people who are harmonious on a deep level, you find people who have a common language, a common religion, common traditions and customs and so forth. Yeah, all of those things are valuable, but the deepest form of harmony is genetic. The most harmonious people in the world are identical twins, right? The greater the relatedness, the genetic relatedness between two people, the greater the harmony between them, in the sense that they understand one another and they share the same values and the same outlook on life. The same way of life feels right for them. And that means that when they face political issues, political problems, they're going to more easily harmonize and work together to solve those problems. Whereas a society where people have, first of all, no real common genetic relatedness, and then different religions, different languages, different cultures, different histories, that's a society where if there are any serious political issues that require people to work together, it just doesn't have the resources to do that. People don't understand and trust one another. If there's a crisis, for instance, and say foreign aid is coming into Britain because you've had a terrible crisis, right? The generous people of Nigeria are sending aid to starving Britons. You know damn well that the
AIDS,
yes, I know. I'm being facetious, right? But just imagine if the generous people of Ethiopia and Nigeria were sending aid to Great Britain because you were having a famine or something. You know very well that this would be just siphoned off by ethnic mafias, right? If the people distributing aid in a particular town are Pakistanis, it's all going to be siphoned off into the Pakistani community. right?
Yeah, people,
that's the way it works.
Yeah,
and so there's just no resources in a society with a heterogeneous population for political unity and common and action for the common good, right? Because there is no common good, because these people aren't really related. And the attitude of these different people in Britain or America today is not that they are coming here to shoulder the burdens and contribute to the national debt, right? When these Mexicans sneak across the border, they are not coming here so that they can shoulder $100,000 in national debt, right? Or $500,000 in national debt, which is what every American, you know, supposedly owes. It, of course, the last time I looked at that was 5 years ago. It's probably tripled. They're not coming here to share our burdens, right? They're not coming here to contribute to our societies. They're coming here to take from us, right? There's no notion of a common good. These societies to them are just giant cash machines.
Yeah, and when you say to take from us, some people would say, well, they pay tax, but even then they're taking that job from someone else.
They're taking the job from one of our people. Certainly Mexicans in America, even if they have jobs and even if they pay taxes, they still disproportionately use the system, right? White Americans are 60-some percent of the population, and we pay 70-some percent of the taxes, okay? We are being sponged off by non-whites who pay less into the system than they get out. It's a giant racial redistribution racket, and the reason they're coming here is because we provide them a better life than they could get in their home country, and they're parasites on the system. So nobody comes to America today to become part of America, to take on common burdens, right? And to try and make America great. They're coming here to take stuff, and they send money back to their families in Mexico or the Philippines. That's what we have now. We have a situation where under the guise of all these glowing multicultural cliches that the left puts out, we've created a society of warring predatory tribes, right? And whites are simply being skinned by these people. We are being victimized by these people, and we're losing our future. We're losing our countries and our future.
One of a wonderful quote that you said in it was a speech you gave called The Refutation of Libertarianism. And I was listening to it one day. I think it's one of the London Forum speeches. And at one point you said the individualist game blinds its players to collectivist cheats. How
right.
Do you explain that?
Well, it's very simple. Most people who are coming into our societies come from collectivist societies. And you can look at maps. There are global maps, right, that map out traits like individualism versus collectivism. And there are also global maps but maps of, say, the United States, right, that map out state by state where the people are coming from that are the largest ethnic group, the largest immigrant group, right, what countries they're coming from. And in fact, if you go to the blog by Lawrence Murray, Atlantic Centurion, he has near the top or at the top such a map, right, that shows the places where most American immigrants are coming from state by state. Turns out that three states are getting most of their immigrants from Canada. Well, that's not bad, right? But the vast majority of states are getting immigrants from Mexico, the Dominican Republic, India. And if you go and you look at maps that map out individualism versus collectivism, all these countries are far more collectivistic than the United States. And so what's happening is we are getting these tight ethnocentric ethnic mafias coming into our country. And what they do is they work together. They help one another, right? And when they interact with us, though, they demand that we treat them fairly, right? That we treat them all as individuals, that we don't treat them as members of a group, and that we don't give any preference to people who are related to us. Now, if you play by those rules, right, where you are a pious, race-blind, culture-blind individualist, and you are interacting with people who demand that you be individualistic in your dealings with them, but when they have any favor to grant you, right, they are always thinking about how to maximize not their individual interests, but their tribal interests, what you're going to find is you are slowly going to lose your society to these people, because in terms of game theory, collective strategies beat individual strategies. Okay. Now, the trouble with these collectivistic societies is that on the whole, they're poorer and more chaotic and more corrupt than individualistic societies, right? But to have an individualistic society like Europe has created, and therefore to have high social trust, prosperity, rule of law, low corruption, and things like that, you've got to exclude these parasite tribes that will come in and work the system. And basically, the longer they stick around, the more power they're going to have in your society, because they're exploiting your openness to them, but they're not reciprocating, right? And so there's going to be a constant, you know, built-in game theoretical advantage to their parasite tribal strategy. And if you have enough of these people, or if you have even a small number of them for a very long time, you're going to end up losing control of your society. And that's what's happening in Western societies. We're too individualistic for our own good when we allow these parasite collectivist groups to come in and basically work the system and cheat us.
Yeah, that's I mean, the it's a fascinating idea that if you're playing the game of life or whatever, society, commerce, in a certain way, that way, that model that you have of society can actually blind you to a completely different and contrary strategy, which will actually annihilate you in the end.
Yeah, and if you preserve your individualistic society by excluding entire groups of people that don't play by those individualistic rules, then on a meta level, you are a collectivist, right? That's my argument for why libertarian individualism fails as a strategy. It fails as a strategy because it presupposes an underlying collectivism, a collectivism where you recognize that your individualist principles are not universal. They're a European thing, right? And you cannot preserve those principles by having open borders and being open to people who don't play by those rules. And therefore, you simply have to exclude these other tribes in toto. And that means, you know, it's childish and stupid and self-defeating for you to say, well, there are some good Muslims. Not all Muslims are like that. I'm sorry, there are not enough good Muslims for our tastes. And the fact of the matter is that if we play by that individualistic, by those individualistic rules, we're going to lose. That's why we're losing already. So we've got to simply stop it and squelch that inclination on our part.
For me,
we've got to exclude them all. They have to all go back.
I mean, what I would say when you say that there aren't enough good Muslims for our taste, what I would say is it's not even a matter of how many good ones there are. As I said to Sargon earlier, the issue is that the moderates will be overtaken by the extremists when push comes to shove. And because that is the nature of, well, any animal reverts to its most extreme version of itself in an emergency. And so the moderates will simply be, they don't matter. They're not flavorsome enough to present a response to a situation, whereas the extremists are, and they epitomize that group, that group's nature. So of course, right, the others will, what's the word, kowtow to them and rely on, right, them to give a characteristic, fulsome response to the, right, situation.
Yeah, and even if there are some really very nice Muslims, right? And I recognize there are moderate Muslims. The moderate Muslims that you hear about on TV are the Ba'athists, right? That are, you know, our Western regimes talk about moderate Muslims to try and lull us into a false sense of security about the jihadis and Salafists running amok in our society. Well, at the same time, the real moderate Muslims are the Ba'athists that our foreign policy is dedicated to overthrowing. Or the Kemalists, right? The people in Turkey who have now basically been, you know, slowly ratcheted out of power. And now Turkey's becoming a Muslim-dominated society, a religious society again, which is a terrible thing. But The battles between Muslims about things like that are not the sort of things that we need to host in our own societies.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is what I said to Spino. Yeah. You can enter the quagmire of all these conflicts and questions, but the simpler thing is just to keep it homogenous in the first place. Then you don't need to deal with all this shit.
Why do we need to deal with this? Why do we need to host Islamic civil wars in our own societies? And have we forgotten how destructive the Reformation was in our own history? Do we really think that we can just blithely invite millions of Muslims in, and then somehow they're going to have a Reformation on our territory and become modern liberals? It's so childish and stupid.
And there's an added dimension to it as well, because at least with the Reformation, you're talking about two groups who are broadly the same, whereas in the sense that they're both indigenous, native to this land. With Muslims, if you're trying to get them to reform, the ones who didn't want to reform could always say, well, it's the outsider who's asking us to reform.
Right.
It's not this other group of us. It's the outsider. And that if anything's going to make people violent, it's that,
right?
And I mean, it's just, I don't understand how Sargon could be so complacent about that. I mean, I think it's a key point.
Are we talking about Sargon now?
No, well,
I
was talking to him a few hours ago, but it's this idea that we who are alien, foreign to Islam, are going to operate on Islam like a surgeon operating on a body on a table. It's not it's just going to lie there passively.
Yeah,
it's not. It's going to fucking resist with everything it's got.
Right, and it's not our problem. And the people who have made it our problem need to be removed from power and kept out of power forever. They're basically children. They shouldn't be given guns or car keys or political power. And we need to send all of these people, these Muslims, back. They all need to go back. They have a homeland of their own, many homelands, and they can fight for their own future over there. We don't need to be a party to it.
No.
Right. And the idea that we're going to bet our entire future as a civilization on civilizing these desert savage barbarians is just insanity. It's utterly insane.
Well, I mean, we saw yesterday that in Germany that there's another that this is another attack with the truck. And
I was not staying very far from there when I was in Berlin earlier this year. You know, not all Muslims are going to kill not all Christmas shoppers, right? That's my response to the Naxal people. Not all Muslims are going to kill not all Christmas shoppers, but how do you know that Christmas shopper isn't going to be you or one of the people you love, right? We've got to send them all back.
Because this is what I said to Sargon again at the border. You can't interview someone at the border and say, "Are you going to be an extremist when you come in?
Well,
are you going to be bad?"
For one thing, they lie.
Of course,
Muslims are, and everybody lies. Okay, everybody lies in every culture, right? I'm
even depressed. The ones who don't lie, you know, once they get in here and they realize it doesn't work out for them. Then the ones who it does work out for, well, what about their kids? What about their grandkids? We know that
the tendency is they become more radicalized with subsequent generations. But, you know, every culture tells lies and everybody's capable of lying. And there's a lot of, you know, slackness and lackadaisicalness about lying in our community, unfortunately. But in their culture, it is a religious requirement to deceive the infidel. It is one of the tools of jihad. They feel totally moral about deceiving us, right? Mm. You know, white people, Christians, whatever, pagans, good white people feel guilty about lying. They feel quite righteous about lying because it's a tool of war against us. So the idea that we're going to go around and we're going to give a questionnaire to Muslims and we're going to say, well, if you believe in our values and renounce jihad forever, you can stay. And if you don't toe the line, you have to go. What are the chances they're going to be honest?
No.
And again, are we going to bet the future of our civilization on these people being honest? Are we that stupid?
And the other aspect of it is their kids and grandkids. You know, this is what, again, I'm going to probably keep referring to Sargon because the things that he said, the answers to them are now more clear to me while I talk to you. I said, what about their kids and grandkids? And he said, well, it's a matter of acculturating them to our way of life. And I was trying to say, well, yeah, but ethnicity matters to people. You know, it's an instinctive, an intrinsic thing. You're going to search for the software for your hardware. And, you know, Islam has grown up in the Middle East over 1400 years. That's how long it's had to optimize itself for their nature, for their inherent nature. And also it's just associated with them after 1400 years. That's your thing. So,
right.
For a deracinated teenage Muslim living in the West, yes, he can join the trashy, nihilistic culture of the modern West, or he can reach back to something which is more real to him and feels more real to him.
Right.
And that's not something that's amenable to us.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
this is what I was trying to impress upon Sargon, that genetics matter. Even if you don't believe in racial differences, they still matter because they mark, because they're a marker of identity.
Yeah, there are different populations find different ways of life congenial to them, and if you look at the history of Islam, I mean the Muslims murdered the people who didn't like Islam, right? They've set up a dysgenic breeding strategy for more than 1,000 years to produce the Muslim man, right, who fits in with this mentality. These people are a different breed of animal.
A different breed of human being, yeah.
Yeah, and they're not easily domesticated to our way of life. And why should we? They've got their own countries. They have nothing to offer us. What do these people have to offer us? Shawarma? That's just puke, that is. That's just, you know, I'm sorry, but Mexican food and Middle Eastern food is not fit for pigs.
Do you have the text chat window open on the right-hand side?
Yes.
Just make sure, yeah. I'm not sure if Bain is going to come back in, but it's a good idea to keep that open. Well, yeah, these are the frustrations that I wish I could communicate to people. And that I do think we need to get better at saying these things because it's becoming very, very important. But I also think that this latest attack with the truck, each time something like this happens, I try to look for differences in the public reaction compared with the last time it happened. And I'm sort of desperately looking for
good signs.
Yeah. Well, signs of awakeness, but this time it just feels immediately different. There's something has definitely changed. I think,
Tell me.
Well, I just think that there's a darker tone to the response. It's, it's not wishy-washy, and it's not reluctantly anti-immigrant. I suppose I'm using the left's language there. It just seems more shamelessly annoyed, shamelessly angry. There doesn't seem to be the same restraint to what I'm saying. And obviously, you still get the liberal who's saying it's not all Muslims and, you know, whatever. There's still, but that liberal is increasingly a lonely figure now, I think. I mean, when I compare this with, like, Charlie Hebdo, mm-hmm. which is nearly, it's damn near 2 years ago now, that was a very much more, happy clappy response to that, because the liberals immediately were animated and saying, well, it's not this, and I'm with Charlie, I am Charlie, and all this. This time, I really don't see that. What I see is the shark circling Angela Merkel.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you get that feeling?
I haven't been able to follow it because I've been super busy with other stuff.
Maybe I've been imagining it.
No, I don't.
I wonder, because obviously there is the danger that you just see what you want to see. But
right,
it just does seem very different this time.
I think it's
because they thought they were going to get a difficult summer, and they did. And then the sort of assumption is, well, after the hot weather's over, people will calm down. And then in the middle of winter, this happens. And then of course there's the symbology of it, the symbolism of it with a Christmas market, and Christmas mm-hmm. has a certain Germanic feel to it. Molyneux was saying this stuff. Molyneux did a 15-minute video about this. Mm-hmm. I dare say I'll make a more extensive one tomorrow. But he said that Christmas seems kind of German. And when you see this truck and there are Christmas trees, it's just, there's a line on the ground.
Yeah.
And you think, how is that? God, that feels symbolic, you know? And it's just so awful to imagine Germans being destroyed like that. Yeah, just innocent, well-meaning people, the cream of Europe.
Going off for buying Christmas ornaments and gifts.
Yeah, for their friends. I mean, an act of love. I mean, you can say it's all commercialism now. Yeah, piss off. It is an act of love. And that's what they were engaging in. And that was done to them. And, mm-hmm. I find this, and I think a lot of people find this inherently sickening.
It is inherently sickening. We can't have our Mardi Gras anymore. We can't have our Christmas anymore.
I'll put it another way. I think people inherently find it sickening rather than it being inherently sickening. I think people immediately, they sort of innately think, oh God, there's something really bad. In the same way that when you see that in the Nice truck attack, when you saw that photo of the wee girl's body, you cannot help but be disturbed by that viscerally.
Right.
I think it's the same thing when a truck, when a Muslim, and we think it's a Muslim, it seems to have been a Muslim.
It was a Muslim. Refugee.
I know that the original suspect, it's when something like that attacks a Christmas market in Germany in the middle of winter, it's so European, it's so nice. I mean, how can you not find that just very disturbing?
Right. We can't have nice things, right? We can't have Christmas. We can't have Bastille Day. We can't have Mardi Gras because we have Muslims. We can't have New Year's celebrations because we have Muslims. At a certain point, we just have to stop these evil people who are running our society and say, you know, we want our society back, and you have to go. And all the Muslims you brought in have to go too.
It's a similar thing with when Trump got in, that delegitimized the entire mainstream media. Because, you can say that this outlet had been pro-Trump or this one had been undecided, whatever. The vast majority, I mean, the thing as a whole, the mainstream media as a whole had been anti-Trump. And therefore, when he got in, that showed them up as not only being out of sync with the public, but also out of sync with honesty. And I think in the same way, it's we're getting to this stage where each new terror attack delegitimizes the establishment that enabled these terror attacks.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I think we're definitely reaching that point.
I mean, obviously to you and me, it's looked like that for a very long time, but I think it's now becoming obvious even to, well, just to everyone.
I think so too. I think once Trump's inauguration is finally over with and he's actually president of the United States, I think we're going to see a change in
people's
willingness to speak about this sort of stuff, because he's going to be speaking about it.
Yeah. And that's something that I've been hoping for ever since he was elected, and maybe even before that. It occurred to me that there is going to be a reaction in Europe to, and there is, now, a disgusted reaction to the fact that Americans have voted in this buffoon, this bombastic character, and they'll say racist, bigot, whatever, and they'll resist. And that's what the BBC are doing, and so on. And lots of, honestly, most ordinary Britons, I think, they would never vote for someone like Donald Trump. He's simply too big a character. He's too loud. And that will be even more the case in, for example, Germany, where their politicians are incredibly bland and boring. That's how it's done.
We can't have anybody charismatic in politics. You know where that leads,
or even anyone interesting. So, yeah. There is this sort of allergic reaction to him just now, and but what I'm hoping is that will, as his influence is enacted, as it manifests, I hope that allergic reaction will be allayed and will give way to actually an understanding that this does work. You know, nationalism does actually work. Even civic nationalism is much, much better than social democracy, egalitarian, universalist social democracy.
Right.
So I'm hoping that the fact that he's in America, and he's obviously the most powerful political figure in the world, I'm hoping that will alter the narrative everywhere. And I think it probably will, because as you say, he's going to be saying these things on TV. And yeah, I think that people, it will normalize in-group preference.
Right. He's referred to Angela Merkel as the woman who's ruined Germany.
Well, I mean, and that's increasingly what normal people are saying as well.
Yeah.
So thank God we've got a politician who, and a powerful one, someone who's in charge, who agrees with us.
Yeah.
Because that's the mainstream. I mean, that is actually the normal. I don't know. Have I ever met someone who disagreed with that? I don't think so.
After the Cologne ficky attacks at New Year, the stupid liberal female mayor of Cologne said that we're going to create a safe space for women at Mardi Gras time.
Oh, yeah.
And my tweet was, you know, why can't all of Germany be a safe space for women?
Yeah, for right. German women. I mean,
Why can't all of Germany be a safe space? And that's really what borders does. Borders create a country that's a safe space for our kind of people. That's what nationalism does. Nationalism creates a safe space for our people. That's why we need to have it. And wouldn't it be, I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art with a friend of mine, and we were walking through the arms and armor galleries, which are one of my favorite parts of the museum. It's just amazing stuff, right? And, you know, thousands of ornate and beautiful ways to kill people. Anyway, there was this mother and her two daughters were wandering through it, and they were so beautiful, beautiful, beautiful people. And I said to my friend, there needs to be some kind of little reservation to keep people like this around, right? And then I thought, yeah, there was. We called it Europe. You know, we need to have Europe back as a safe space for our people.
Yeah. Well, that's the remarkable thing. You know, over the last 70 years, we've come to, well, our politicians have come to this idea that Europeans don't need a special place. In fact, that eventually morphed into they should not have a safe space, a place of their own. It's outrageous to even
suggest. No, we should have purgatory. All of our countries should be purgatory for the imagined sins of racism. Fuck that. I'm sorry. You know, yeah. I've got some choice places.
Well, the thing is, it's all
for
or
the people who are pushing that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, it's all or nothing. You know, if we are guilty for the past, then you have to be sure of the sentence that you're passing on us, because by bringing in mass immigration, that's not just a light reprimand. That's eventual.
That's genocide.
Yeah.
It's genocide at the worst, civil war and ethnic cleansing and genocide of them when you get right down to it at the best. That's not something to bet our future on. Again, I come back to this. Liberals in America basically bet everything on the following theory, right? Now, they're all a bunch of liberal white people in charge of the Democratic Party. A lot of them are quite rich. And what they bet their future on is this, that inside of every jihadi and every MS-13, you know, gang member with a tattooed face, you know, and, 40 confirmed kills coming up from Latin America is a swipple who's just dying to get out, right? Yeah. And, you know, inside of every one of these people is a swipple. They're all going to be drinking lattes and buying food at Trader Joe's. And, you know, basically the whole stuff white people like checklist, they want that so bad that we don't even have to try to assimilate them. In fact, we're going to bend over backwards and forwards to accommodate all of their barbaric tastes and customs. And still, they're somehow going to become like us. And therefore, and also, they will always consent to being led by white liberals. And they will consent to being led by white liberals even when they become the absolute majority, especially the absolute majority of Democratic voters.
Yeah.
And these people who have come from countries where, you know, women's rights and gay rights and the environment and the arts, namely white people arts, and all this stuff, feminism, don't have any place in those societies, but somehow they are going to be the loyal dray animals, right, that are going to be carrying that agenda forward into the future.
Well, we're seeing
that that's just not happening. That's so dumb, and it's not happening. And right now, there's a revolt in the Democratic Party. It's like enough white candidates. We need black people running this party, right?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, well, I know that would be strategically useful for us. But it does interest me how myopic the average liberal is about other cultures. I mean, you know that what they really want is for them, for the immigrants, to just become like them in every imaginable way,
right?
Ultimately, because they're as tribal as everyone else. I mean, they ultimately want the other to disappear and the other to become them. But they hope it'll happen culturally first, because the racial difference of the other is useful to the liberal because it makes them feel open-minded. And also the cultural angle as well is useful because it makes them feel open-minded, but he ultimately does expect them to become just like him. And this really does amaze me, because it's so contrary to what they claim and even what they think about themselves. I mean, if the liberal, I don't know how much serious self-reflection the average liberal has, but I suspect if one of them were on his own one day at his home just thinking about the world, I don't think he would even realize this about himself, that ultimately he is not interested in the methods of basket weaving of some country in the Middle East. You know, he doesn't give a flying fuck about these things, because why would he and why should he? You know, ultimately it's irrelevant to him. And what he really wants is someone who is a bit different from him in terms of genetics, but goes to the same art galleries as him, goes to the same rock festivals as him, goes to the same trendy hipster bar as him. That's what he wants. And ultimately, as I say, he'll also want them to be genetically assimilated into his group so that he doesn't have that head fuck to deal with all the time. I mean, it's such that this idea of open-mindedness is such an illusion. I think the very idea that they preach it goes is an immediate sign of their lack of self-knowledge. But I mean, we don't have one of them here with us to protest that rather damning statement. But again, then again, I'm not really interested in the protestations of people who don't have self-reflection.
Right.
You know, I recently this has really come up, and it's I won't go into it, but it just angers me. I think that without self-reflection, your words are fucking worthless. If you don't know yourself, you don't really know, you can't possibly know the world. And I think that, I mean, this is what we're dealing with now. We seem to be heading towards a Rubicon moment where the sheer amount of delusion that is built up, that has accumulated over the last, let's just say 70 years, it's longer than that, but whatever, is that sheer amount of accumulated delusion is starting to really become toxic and actively dangerous, even on a day-to-day basis. And it's becoming untenable. Because of that, because of those effects that it's now having. And I also think that the Trump and Hillary election just showed this. I mean, the media was utterly disingenuous. And I think that some of them are doing that with self-knowledge, but most of them are doing it just because they've never bothered to look at themselves in their fucking lives. I mean, it's all social. It's all social signaling.
Right. Yeah, just the lack of basic self-knowledge and basic authenticity on the part of these people is very, very disturbing.
Well, of course, the question of authenticity, that's an interesting thing in itself, because I think it's a sort of established idea that the middle-class liberal is a creature without any authenticity. I mean, to some extent, it is true to say that the middle class don't have a culture. They get it from elsewhere. It's not something that it's not tied to them in the way that a working class culture is, or indeed ethnic culture is. So when they feel naked and when they worship the other, worship the outsider, there is a good reason for that. Of course there's middle class culture, but it's always this detached. It's not quite authentic. And I don't know whether that's just the age we live in or if it's always been like that. I think part of being middle class is affecting detachment from things. So inevitably their culture is going to be like that. But then it has this effect of making them feel vulnerable and hollow. So they look to the other to fill them up. Well, literally.
Right, right. There's a certain white people disease of basically thinking that we somehow incarnate universal humanity, right? We're just universal humanity exemplars of that walking around, which is why they think that everybody wants to be us, right? Because we're really them anyway. And I think that that's a lack of self-knowledge. It's a delusional, self-congratulatory view of things. But if people actually get past that and realize, no, the things that we like are really specifically European, culturally, historically, and genetically European, then they become authentic. Self-knowledge and authenticity really have to go hand in hand, right? You can be utterly deluded about your identity, not really know who you are. And when you start learning who you are, then you've got a choice, which is to own up to who you are, or just sort of go back to being deluded about what this really means and what this really requires. Because there is a sort of a burden of authenticity, right? One of the things that liberalism tries to do is it just gives you the idea that there are no hard choices in the world.
Yeah, everything's a commodity.
Yeah, and there are no hard choices. But when you get outside that mindset, you realize, no, there really are hard choices. They're ultimately existential, blood and guts sorts of choices. When you realize who you are and that you are carrying forward a bloodline and a tradition, and that it's all come down to you, right? and you got to carry it forward somehow. That's a pretty sobering thing. That requires grown-ups. And liberalism is almost like permanent infantile, you know, behavior. The idea that you can be anything, that you can make any choice, that it's revisable, you know, that you can always undo things that you've done. It's a childish, light notion of reality.
Yes, indeed. It speaks of a shallowness and an insincerity. There was something that you just said that gave me an idea, but it's just vanished out of my head. Bain, is your microphone working or not? You want to try it?
You know, he just wanted to listen in, and I didn't realize that I was sending him the link that would actually bring him into the conversation.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I am here. Right. I was just eavesdropping for a little bit.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, I misunderstood. I thought I was just sending him the link so he could listen on YouTube.
Oh, and, okay. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned that there were some questions that people had submitted. Maybe we can talk about some of those.
Yeah, sure. I'll find them for you. That might stimulate some thoughts. Hold on a second. I will refresh this page. I don't know how often people are posting. If you do have any questions for Greg, you can post them under the advert video for the Millennial Hangouts. Okay. Right, here we go. Do you think that the final step for the alt-right might be what it is now? A loose confederation of countercultural whites who dwell primarily on the internet and are only really united together for a common goal of survival. Do you think that's the ultimate, the final step for the alt-right?
Well,
I know you're not entirely happy with that label. I know that.
I'm just thinking. Well, no, I mean, that's not the final step, because that presupposes that we are not going to win, right? I want to win. And I define winning as achieving complete cultural and political hegemony for our ideas, so that no matter where you go, you know, no matter where you go up and down the political spectrum, no matter what political party you belong to, no matter what church or religious group you belong to, no matter what subculture, no matter what kind of fanboy you are, right, that the discourse is dominated by white interests, white identity, and white flourishing. And there's simply no acceptable place in our society where the degradation and denigration and destruction of white people can be entertained in polite company.
Yeah.
That's victory as I define it. And at that point, it doesn't matter about, you know, the political parties can all stay the same, but they'll all just be different versions of white nationalism. That's what I want. I want a total control of discourse by our ideas, but a kind of soft control. That's what the term hegemony means. It's kind of soft power. It's one level removed from state power. It's cultural and political, cultural power primarily, but it filters down and shapes the political spectrum so that no matter where you turn on the spectrum, everything is pre-harmonized to white interests. That's what I want. And obviously we're not going to get there simply by remaining a loose coalition of people on the internet. What I would like to see in a year's time is new institutions popping up that will be mainstreaming our ideas and injecting our ideas into the political policy process for the Trump administration. I'd like to see that in a year. I was hoping the National Policy Institute would do that, but that's not going to happen. And I think that, you know, in 5 years' time, I want there to be many such institutions. I want there to be many public advocates for our ideas, people who go out in 3D meat space under their own names with their own faces and advocate for our ideas. I want there to be so many of these people and for our ideas to be so visible that it is simply not possible any longer for us to be suppressed and shamed and silenced and terrorized and harassed like we are today. There's a movie. This is actually a really interesting movie from a political point of view, in terms of lessons for radical politics, including our politics. And just one second, I'm going to mute my microphone. I'm going to start coughing. One sec.
Okay.
Just while
that wasn't so bad. Yeah, that wasn't so bad. Anyway, it's Milk, the movie about Harvey Milk, starring Sean Penn as Harvey Milk. It's actually a really interesting movie about politics, and it's also a very interesting movie illustrating things that we believe about the Jewish question too. But there was a proposition in the 70s in California called Proposition 8, I believe, which was basically designed to, I guess, basically fire homosexual school teachers. And it was being pushed by Anita Bryant and the evangelical churches. And anyway, the campaign against it was very, very clever. And I think that we need to take this seriously. Basically, what they said, the strategy, the strategic thinking was this. They feel like they can oppress us because we're invisible. Therefore, if we increase our visibility, it will not be easy for voters to vote yes on Proposition 8. And so they basically wanted closeted gays to come out and to do it at the same time across the state. And they did. And the reasoning was is that it's very, very easy to vote yes on 8 if you don't know anybody who's gay.
Right.
Or you don't know anybody who knows anybody who's gay, right? And that goes for white nationalists too. That same principle applies to us. It's very, very easy for people to dismiss us and to accept media concocted images of us if they don't actually know any of us or know somebody who knows somebody who's us, right? But if we gain that greater visibility on, you know, just the, you know, ordinary day-to-day life, we are going to short-circuit the media's power to misrepresent us. We are going to be able to seize control of the narrative and seize control of our image in the public mind. When we achieve that level of visibility, it will be very difficult for our ideas to be put back in the margins of society. And it does not require an absolute majority of people who believe the things that we believe to change society. If you just have a energized, principled minority, we can change society. I mean, look what Jews have accomplished with 2.5 or 3% of the population, right? They basically control this society. There's no reason why 5 or 10% of white people can't basically be the tail that wags the entire dog someday. And within 5 years, I want us to be far more visible. Within 10 years, I want us to be that 5 or 10%. And I think that will happen. All the trends are conspiring to make that happen. All the push trends of the bad policies that have been baked into the system and will continue to echo forward in time are going to be pushing people in our direction. Plus, there's going to be an additional factor, I should say, that we now have on our side, which is the pull factor, the pull of it being possible now, people being able to envision a solution to this. That's something new, right? Trump's election makes more things possible because it makes it possible for people to envision a path to where we want to go. So the push of bad policies and the pull of being able to envision solutions, I think, is going to create a great swell of support towards our positions. The only thing that's a problem here is this. The growth of our movement over the last couple of years has been tremendous, but our infrastructure has not been able to keep up. There are no more professional white nationalists today than there were 5 years ago in the United States. Okay. Our ability to raise funds is the same as it was a few years ago.
Has the growth come from then?
Yeah, well, the growth is coming from people who are interested in our ideas and are accessing it on the internet for free, right? But we don't have the back office, the institutions necessary to capture all this energy, raise funds from it, mobilize these people, and actually push them towards creating change. We don't have that infrastructure yet. There's so much potential, but we don't have the infrastructure yet to make that happen. That is the great problem we're going to have to face in the next couple of years. We need people who can build institutions and manage institutions. I've created a small business, Countercurrents, right?
Yeah.
I suck at running a small business. I am totally not cut out for it. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, people complain about the 1%, right? The truth of the matter is that less than 1% of people are capable of creating and running institutions. You know, I'm in that one less than 1%, and I suck at it, okay? We need better people, okay? We need better people who are better at creating and running institutions, and that means people who are capable of multitasking and grinding through lists and doing boring stuff that's unglorious sometimes. We need more people like that.
Oh,
and
I
agree. I'm constantly looking out for people like that and trying to say, you know, you join us, you will be heroes to future generations. There's a chapter in Mein Kampf where he talks about, it's the chapter on propaganda and organization. And there's great stuff about propaganda in there, but the stuff on organization was wonderful. And one of the things that Hitler said is that it was one of the great leaps forward for the party was when they hired their first full-time office manager, somebody who was just there to answer the phone and sign for deliveries, right?
Right, because that's a feeling of permanence.
Right, right. Once you've got somebody there who's just responsible for that kind of stuff, order can you know, crystallize around it, right? It's like having a catalyst, right? You've got all the chemicals are in a beaker, but you need something to catalyze it so that that something forms, right? And the catalyst was just having a guy there who was responsible to run an office. And that was a catalyst around which all this order formed. And we're at the stage where we don't even have a back office, right? We need something, though, to catalyze this movement into institutional growth, to found and grow institutions. Mm. It's going to happen. I'm looking for people to do that. And in a year, there will be new institutions. In 5 years, there will be many institutions, and we will become much more visible. In 10 years, you know, we'll be setting the agenda for the Donald Trump Jr. administration. That's how I envision it. So,
well, the rest of the question was sort of going into the territory that you've just explored. Should the alt-right continue to influence mainstream politics as it has done so far through memes, critique, satire or mockery, crime statistics, and all the other activism that we do? Or do you think we should get involved in politics in a more direct way, such as a real political party, or just try to become the Republican Party?
I think we should keep influencing politics however we can do it. Keep influencing discourse however possible, right? Should we have our own party or become the Republican Party? I don't think we should have our own party. We should become the Republican Party, and we should become the Democratic Party and the Libertarian Party and the Green Party and any other party that comes along. We are going to hollow those out, right, and colonize them with our people, so that no matter what you vote for, it's going to be safe for white survival and white flourishing. That's my vision. That's the hegemonic vision that I have. In terms of running for office, I just think that's a terribly stupid waste of time and money in the U.S. context. We have a two-party condominium, right? Third parties go nowhere. If you actually are serious about gaining political power, you must run as a Republican or a Democrat. Yes, there's Bernie Sanders, who's an independent in Vermont, but he ran as a Democrat when he wanted to become president. So you've got to be a Republican or a Democrat to be a serious contender for political power. Third parties, independent parties, they don't go anywhere. And in a movement that is strapped for cash, political campaigns are the one thing that will reliably get people to part with their money, and that it is just completely and totally wasted. I think there's no greater waste of money for our movement than supporting political candidates. I saw this in 2008 with Ron Paul. There were people who were honest to God, bona fide national socialists who were writing checks of thousands of dollars to the Ron Paul campaign, and Ron Paul didn't agree with their principles, but he'd sure take their money because that agreed with his libertarian principles, right? And these people had never given a fraction of that amount of money to the actual movement, right? To advance our ideas rather than mainstream politicians. I saw people do the same thing in 2012 with the Ron Paul campaign. Years ago, they were, white nationalists were giving money to Patrick Buchanan when he was running. And, you know, there's just such a low return on investment for donations to political campaigns that don't win and are not really a very effective platform for propagating our ideas. I'm sorry, they're just not a very effective platform. David Duke's recent campaign, I don't know how much money was donated to that, but it was basically all wasted. And what return did he get for that? Well,
I think it was 6% of the voters.
I thought it was 3%, but 6 or 3%, it's still nothing, right? It's not political power. He got on a debate. I saw him in a debate. The debate was not a very effective platform for him, given that he has his own media platforms. Yeah, maybe there were new people watching the debate. I don't know. It seems likely. But the fact of the matter is that I do not think that was a very good return on investment, especially because the guy has his own platforms and is constantly putting out good material. Duke is great for putting out videos and commentary and stuff like that. He's doing great work. Running for office is just a distraction from that great work. And I'm sure a lot of people part with money for it that won't part with money for, you know, sort of hard metapolitical work. But the fact of the matter is, it's not a good use of our resources. So yeah, running for office in the present climate, and especially running for office as an independent or a libertarian or some other third party or the American Freedom Party or whatever it is, I just don't think that's a very good use of money because it doesn't translate into political power and it's not a very effective tool of metapolitical organizing and propaganda.
That's the key thing, right? There's a guy in Britain called Joe Owens, and he always says, his channel's been taken down now for some, I don't really know why, but anyway, he was always saying, he's one of the old sort of BNP generation, and he was constantly saying that the thing to do is, you know, run for politics and try to get voted in, create a party and try to get it voted in. Now, I mean, that just seems to me really naive because it takes decades to get, I mean, UKIP has been going since, I think it was 92 or 93. It's been going for about 20 years, maybe longer, 25 years. And it's still, even now, it's struggling to even be noticed among, I mean, it's noticed, it's known of, it is, it's acknowledged, but it has, they have no power. And it's, in terms of actual politicians, I think they've got one. In one politician in the House of Commons, it takes ages to do that. And also, I think that our politics are simply too far outside the Overton window just now. What, let's say that you did somehow manage to get a white nationalist politician elected. What's he going to do? Nothing. I mean, he will achieve nothing. And if he were on the verge of achieving something, he would have to deal with the comeback from the media, who would absolutely crucify him for doing anything vaguely white nationalistic, which, mm-hmm. I mean, it's this is the point. You have to lay the groundwork, and that means changing the culture. And it means, as I've used the phrase before, I used it in the speech at the Northwest Forum, reprogramming the white race, which is a big phrase, it's grandiose, but what has been done to us is very sophisticated and grandiose, or grand. We are in a position where our instincts have been made to feel outrageous and alien. So that is a very extreme conditioning that's been done. So we have to decondition that. And that is not going to be done in 6 months or a year. And it certainly can't just be ignored, which is what people are proposing when they say that we should just stand for office. Like, oh, we should just ignore this huge thing that's been done to us to make us resist any kind of in-group preference.
Right.
And what planet are you living on? You know, that's never, ever going to work. No, it's putting the cart before the horse. You have to do this groundwork first.
And then, metapolitics comes before politics.
Yeah, and then the voting in of parties, the creation of parties, white nationalist parties, the voting in of them, and their enacting of their policies will all happen far more naturally. If you don't do that groundwork first, we have a phrase in Britain, I don't know if you have it in America, you're just pissing into the wind.
Right. Well, in the United States especially, our electoral system works in such a way that if you're not a Republican or a Democrat, you have practically no representation. Now, if we went to a proportional representation system, that might change the game. And if there were to be some constitutional amendments in the United States down the road, one, to get rid of birthright citizenship, that would be very, very important. I think another would be to simply adopt a proportional representation system so that a party that gets above a certain threshold of support automatically gets representation in the Congress. That would be very, very good. That could help. But and in Europe, there are parties that are doing very well. And so they are all in these proportional representation type parliamentary systems. So they have been able to grow from 0 to 36 or 40% of the electorate over time. Whereas we, third parties in America, they never get past, 0 or 1%. They just never have the chance to grow, because to grow, they have to succeed a little bit and then a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And really, without proportional representation, they don't have that opportunity. So I think that if we had a different system, it would make more sense, but it doesn't make sense at present. But here's the thing. Again, my vision of how this is going to work is not even going to really require new parties, because the old parties are simply going to be vessels for the ideas that we put forward. I think that is a more realistic way of going about it in the United States. If you are a white nationalist and you got a clean record and a good resume, become a Republican. Some of you might want to become Democrats if you've got the connections and you're in a solidly Democratic area of the country. Some of you might even become Democrats. We need to hollow out these parties and replace them with our people. And
yeah, I agree. And just before you go on, some people are saying, they've pointed out what I said earlier, that UKIP took, you know, they've been around for over 20 years, and they're not near power. Someone's pointed out that they did get the Brexit referendum. That's true. But they're still not in power. And also, the Brexit referendum is, that was a sea change in politics, sure, mm-hmm. in British politics, but it's nowhere near what we want. I mean, the kind of stuff that we want is absolutely going to require cultural grounding. The Brexit referendum didn't really. Mm-hmm. So, especially as it was reversing, well, it was undoing something that has been going for 40 years and is purely political, at least on the face of it. Whereas what we want is not purely political, it's, well, genetic. I mean, that's what our ideas reach into. So it's far more fundamental and extreme. It's simply more controversial. So I don't think that the example of UKIP managing to... I'm not trying to denigrate this. I said Nigel Farage is a hero. I think he, as someone said, he's the only politician to really manage to achieve his mission in the last 20 years. Absolutely. But let's be realistic about what lessons can be transferred from one thing to another, and what these things mean. You know, the fact that UKIP got that referendum does not mean that we could start a white nationalist party tomorrow and be anywhere 20 years from now. That it has to be cultural and spiritual, and before it can be political, I think.
Yeah, the fact is, though, that the BNP for a while was moving along, and I think that one of the reasons why, and this is sort of tinfoil hattery perhaps, but when the BNP started doing well, then the mainstream press started giving good press to Farage and UKIP suck some of the wind out of that.
And it was easy to do because the BNP was political, and there was no culture to support the BNP.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's easily, this is how important it is. I mean, you can say they struggled for years and years, and yes, they did. And yes, in the late 70s, before Thatcher took the wind out of their sails, and in 2010, yes, they were just achieving something, but it was so easily taken from them.
It was so easily taken from them. Yeah, and
have that grounding.
Yeah. I think that's a fair description of it. I think during the last election that the BNP was a major, you know, force, they did manage to get more than 1,000 people in Great Britain stand for office. Now that is a remarkable achievement. Okay, you've got how many millions of people in Great Britain?
It's about 60 million.
About 60 million. So we have five times your population. Believe me, I don't think we couldn't find 1,000 people in the United States to publicly declare that they were standing for a white nationalist party. I don't even think we could find 10. We might be able to find 10. I don't think we could find 100. You know, so that's saying something.
The
BNP did mobilize a lot of commitment and idealism.
Well, again, I would say that's a cultural and spiritual thing, though,
because the
English are more tied to their land than the Americans are tied to their land. I mean, it goes back thousands of years.
Right. The English are the people who didn't move to the New World or Australia.
Exactly.
Yeah. Whereas we are the descendants of the rootless people. Yeah, so we are far, far behind Great Britain in our ability to create a functioning political party in the United States. We're far, far behind that. And it didn't go that far or that well in Great Britain, unfortunately.
No. I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate what the BNP achieved or the efforts of these people. I'm just saying, first of all, I think their presentation wasn't good. I think that they didn't really know how to communicate with the public. and in by which I mean the broad public, the middle class, and so on. But also, I think they were naive. You can't. Mm-hmm. The situation has changed so much since 1948 that you cannot just pretend that you can unleash these policies to the public and they'll take it. They will mm-hmm. not. They will resist and recoil. So that is, and it's not because the policies are outrageous. It's because the people have been so outrageously distorted.
Right.
So that's what I would say about that.
Are there other questions?
There's only one other question. How should the alt-right respond to attacks on people like Sherry Spencer? Be careful about, you know, what you say here.
Oh, okay. Well, what happened to Sherry Spencer is disgusting. And I'm very saddened to hear that she and her husband are now selling the building. You should never give into this kind of stuff.
I didn't know they were going to do
yes, that. Yes, and they've made public statements that they disagree with their son's politics and that they don't endorse racism and stuff like that. And that's very unfortunate. But the first thing is that the left needs to learn not to go after people's families. Okay. And I think that the response to this has been good. It's probably been, it could have been better managed if it's possible to manage these things, given that we don't really have a top-down structure and we can't really discipline people. But when this first popped up on the radar, people that I know started looking into Tanya Gersh, who was the realtor who was pushing this. And, you know, and it became apparent that the woman was engaged in criminal behavior, right? It's criminal behavior to basically extort things from people by yes. plying them with threats. The woman was engaged in criminal behavior and just shockingly immoral, brazen behavior. Basically, she went to the tenants in this building and tried to scare them to lower the property value, basically, and to interfere with the contractual relationships between the tenants and the landlord, which is a tort. You can be sued for that, and I hope she will be sued for that. I don't think it's likely at this point, unfortunately, if the family is caving in. But if they were fighting, they should sue her for that, and they should also pursue criminal charges for extortion. And what she did is she was basically threatening to create a circus of protests and things like that to drive the value of the property down, to drive the tenants out, and she was offering to sell it to somebody. And she said she actually had a buyer lined up, clearly one of her friends, right? And she, as a realtor, would take a cut, and then she was suggesting that Sherry Spencer donate the proceeds to an anti-hate group, right, in the same town run by this woman's friends, okay? The brass on this woman, it's just astonishing, right? She had to expect some blowback for this. I guess she probably didn't because she felt immune, right? But the fact of the matter is that nobody's immune from doxing in America. And by doxing, I don't mean, you know, breaking into your house and stealing secrets. I mean just finding publicly available but not necessarily easily available information on you and publicizing that to people who might want to do you harm, people who might hold you in contempt or have ill will towards you. That is easy to do unless you are careful to secure yourself from it. And in this case, it was fairly easy to put together cases for criminal and civil charges against the woman. And that really should have been the direction. But also, of course, this got out to various trolls. And I understand the people in town who were, you know, plotting to do this have been pretty mercilessly trolled. Now, here's the thing. I don't engage in this kind of behavior, and I don't advocate it. I don't condone it. But the fact of the matter is that if you are a journalist or a quote-unquote activist, and you are going to harass the families of white nationalists, innocent parties, if you're going to harass them, you have to expect that there are going to be some righteously indignant people, and that these people often live outside U.S. jurisdiction, and they cannot be extradited even to the United States. These people are often engaged in serious criminal activities that are far riskier than trolling you. And these people are willing to tear your life apart to avenge themselves on you. And that's just the reality of the situation. And these leftists are so smug and so confident that all the institutions of society are on their side, even as they pose as aggrieved outsiders, right? They are so smug, they think they're immune to this. And they're learning that they're not immune. And they are reaping, they've sown the wind, and they're reaping the whirlwind. They're getting back what they put out. And there's a certain karma there. Now, personally, my response to this situation would have been to go through the courts to get the woman fired from her job, get her license as a realtor revoked for unethical behavior, sue her for interference with contracts, and try and get criminal charges brought against her for extortion. I think that would be quite good if even a couple of those things happen. It would be quite good, because we then need to publicize this and let people know there are consequences for this kind of behavior. It is beyond scummy to go after people's family. There was a journalist who contacted me, of all people, and the assumption was, of course, oh, Greg Johnson and Richard Spencer don't get along, so I'll contact Greg Johnson for some juicy quotes. This journalist was trying to do a story about Richard Spencer's wife, Nina. And I wrote back and I said, I'm not going to talk to you, but I'll give you a quote on the record. And the quote was, Nina Kuprianova is not a white nationalist. Her only connection to this movement is being married to Richard Spencer. I understand that they are now separated. If people have problems with Richard, they need to take it up with him and not go after his family And that was it. And so they need to get that message, though. And we need to have a certain amount of solidarity, when these journalists come knocking, not to aid and abet them in making trouble for people's families.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. They have considered themselves invincible because they've held not only the institutions of society for so long, but also the cultural narrative. For so long.
And they've been opposed by these conservative types.
Oh, for so long. They were just waiting to roll over.
Yeah, who only put up a token resistance and then just roll over, right? They've never actually faced a radical, principled, morally indignant and righteous opposition. Yeah. But we're here now, and we're not going to go away, and we're going to steamroll these people. And they're just not ready for it. And one thing that's been so much fun after the Trump election is the unending nervous breakdown of all these leftists. Every morning I fill the tub with liberal tears, and I just wallow in it. It's so good,
Great, because they completely overreact. I mean, maybe in a sense they're not overreacting, because that's complicated, isn't it? Okay, on the one hand they're overreacting because it's not like some rabid racist has taken to the White House. But on the other hand, they're not overreacting because, as I've said before, the left understand trajectories in a way that the right hasn't historically, like the last 100 years. The right has actually been quite just thinking about the last 5 years and the next 5 years and wanting to return things to 5 years ago or 10 years ago. The left understands that things have symbolic weight and therefore the power to galvanize. And so an event is important, and a person is important, and an election is important, not just for what it means for that county, in this 5 years, but what it means about the society in general, and what and how it can push the society in general. You know, the left has understood the power of possibility, whereas the right has just been completely deaf to that for 100 years and has learned defeat. It's learned to be defeatist, and it's learned to that its agency is in waiting for its destruction. And I think that's why now the left just are in a tailspin. They can't quite come to grips with the idea that the corpse has become reanimated and it's now stepping off the slab and coming towards them. It's very scary for them.
Yeah.
But it was inevitable because they kept prodding. They kept going one step further over and over again. And they kept disrespecting. They kept laughing. They kept pretending that we didn't even exist. I mean, they've acted as if we're nothing. That's how they've behaved for, I would say, that definitely the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And so it was time. And of course, they are shocked that, you know, the hour has struck.
Yeah. And it really was 1 minute to midnight, right?
Yeah.
This last, America had come to the crossroads. In 2012, I predicted after the defeat of Mitt Romney that this was the last election where a Republican could even hope to win without appealing to the ethnic interests of white voters. And if Hillary Clinton had gotten elected in last month, she would have opened the floodgates to the third world even wider and legalized tens of millions of illegals. They only admit to there being 11 million here, but there are probably more than 30 million here. And that would have been the end. There would have been a permanent Democratic majority, I should say, and it would be simply impossible for Republicans to ever gain national power, ever gain the presidency. And that would have been an end to all the things that Republicans hold dear. And some of those things I hold dear, such as the Second Amendment and the First Amendment. Okay. These things are very important, and they would have just been swept away if she had gotten into office. We were at a fork in the road. If we turned left, it would have been the end of the possibility of restoring America, restoring it as a white country. If we turned right and voted Trump, we would have a president who is going to build a wall and deport illegals and stop Muslims from coming in. That gives us time, right? It gives us an opportunity to save the country. And I hope that in 4 years' time, he's going to face another tough election, though, because a lot of the white people who voted for him will be dead, and a lot of the non-whites who are under 18, were under 18 and couldn't vote in this last election, will be able to vote. And so it's going to be razor thin again if he gets reelected. And we're going to have to fight these hard, these bitter elections over and over again for a long time and work on fixing the demographic problem. And I think, though, that in 20 years' time, if we have people in power who keep us on this course, we're going to be through the worst of the demographic problems, and we'll be on a good demographic course again. And that's tremendously, tremendously hopeful. And one of the things that's going to help us is that the Democratic Party is in disarray. The non-whites want to take over the party now. The white liberal idea that they were always going to run this thing and that these people were going to be patient and grateful peasants just waiting for the Gibbs is over, right? And they want they want, it's going to be like McDonald's, you know, and it's going to be black 24/7, you know, and well, that's not a good brand, right? That's not a good business model. And it's not a winning strategy, I think, for the Democratic Party. So they're going to be self-destructing and having nervous breakdowns and drowning in their own drool for the next 4 years. And we'll have a very, a president in charge who's trying to fix the worst demographic problems. So I think that, you know, things are going in the right direction.
Well, that's very nice. I hope you're right. But as you say, it's far from over yet. What's really happened here with this election is that the battle lines have been drawn.
Right.
The white race has, to some extent, woken up. And I think they'll continue to wake up because the reaction to this will be and is so extreme that I think the thing I mentioned to Sargon earlier was this appalling, this outrageous, egregious MTV video, New Year's Resolutions for White Men.
I didn't even watch it.
That kind of thing. I watched it. I hesitated for like the first two times it came up, and then the third time I gave in, and my curiosity got the better of me. But the point is that a video like that should be seen in 50 years' time as an artifact of how perverse life was in 2016. Because and it should be unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable, that a media company would produce something like that now. Just as it was unthinkable that they would produce something like that 10 years ago.
Right.
And I don't mean that I want us to return to 2006.
Right.
Obviously not. But it was unthinkable then, and so rapidly the things have coalesced such that a massive media company can put out a video like that proudly and not fear the backlash. As it happened, there was a backlash, and it seems like they've taken that video down.
Interesting. It's a white lash.
Don't quote me on that, but that's what I read just before these hangouts started. In fact, let's just assume that isn't the case, because I don't want to be wrong about that. But the point is that what we want is a future in which that video would be baffling to people. Right. Because the scariest thing about that video is that it's not baffling to us. We understand why that video exists, and we even expect such videos. And that is a terrible to the condition that we are in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we want a future in which we have an immediate allergic reaction to something like that. We have an immediate outrage at that.
Yeah, where the only place that something like that could ever be produced is in a madhouse, right? That's what we really want. I want the left to basically be reduced to the status that pedophiles have today, where they are completely, you know, they have no public space. They have to trade their pictures in, you know, forums, in coded forums in the ass end of the internet or the dark net, right? And that's the only place. They have no safe spaces. They have no public spaces. That's what I want. I want them to be that marginalized. And that's what I mean by hegemony, basically. That this stuff just won't fly in polite company anymore. And we're going to get there.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we want this to be the kind of thing that in polite company would see you ostracized. If that person walked into the room who had done that video, the polite people would ignore them. They'd saunter out outside and be beaten up by the less polite people for making a video like that, which is utterly disgusting.
Right, exactly. So do you want to talk a bit about this assassination in Turkey?
That's probably something for a separate hangout. I don't want to, because I think this has been really unified so far. So I think we'll just call it a day there. Because, unless you think it's relevant to what we've been talking about.
I don't want to talk about the geopolitics or the motivations of it. I simply want to talk about it as television.
I think that was
a gift from God. It was manna from heaven. That's what I thought to myself. This is manna from heaven as I watched that. The loud echoing gunshots, and then this guy, you know, in high dudgeon, babbling Allahu Akbar and all that other stuff. I thought, this is manna from heaven. And it was very amusing to watch the TV and other news commentary on it, where they would have the video, and then they would pretend in the print versions or the print part, they'd be scratching their heads, and they'd call him the alleged gunman, and pretend like they didn't know what he was babbling. I just thought this is priceless, right?
I mean, we were saying Allahu Akbar over and over again, and and I saw a BBC a clip. Where was it? It was uploaded. Oh yes, it was uploaded by one of our channels. It was a BBC clip of the coverage, and someone was saying he made a reference. They totally ignored that he had started it with Allahu Akbar, and then they said that he mentioned Aleppo and revenge, which means mm-hmm. that it's probably revenge for Russia's action in mm-hmm. Aleppo. Mm-hmm. Not at all that. They seem to be deliberately missing the point of these things.
Right. Yes. And didn't he look like a clean cut, nice young man? Big bushy beard, dish towel robes and things
That's another aspect to it. And I don't want to comment on that just now. It is a rather strange occurrence.
Anyway, just as pure television, this does us so much good, I think.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, it is an interesting... of course, yesterday was just kind of weird. You know, there was that. There was the thing in Berlin. There was something in Zurich. I think three people got shot. I don't know if they died. And then I also heard that there was something in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. With a machete, but I can't find any reference to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it happened or not. So it was a strange day, and it's possible. Oh, and also there was it in Belgium? Police swooped down on something else. There was a huge operation that they think they thwarted another terrorist attack there. So it seems to have been. Well, you'd think that was all coordinated, you know, to happen on one day. Seems a bit strange if it was just a coincidence, but who knows?
I think it could be just a coincidence because you've got so many of these terrorists now, and a lot of them are operating fairly independently of one another. Mm. Tomorrow bring?
What will Christmas Day bring? I mean, it's terrifying. You know, it could be a hyper version of what I was describing earlier about last night's attack, our Christmas market, you know.
Yeah.
If there are Christmas mass services or something like that around Germany in cathedrals, you know.
That would be a target, yeah.
And that's terrible. It's just awful.
Yeah.
You know, as usual, things escalate and we've crossed another threshold. But I do think that I think that we're approaching a state of public consciousness. Certainly, I think the Germans, you know, everyone's waiting for the Germans to wake up, and who knows?
I think one thing that we need to bear in mind is that Germans, like other Nordic peoples, keep things bottled up. Right. And there's also, emotionally speaking, it's just our style. Right. But there's another factor here. Of course, they're keeping things bottled up because the system is intimidating and suppressing it. Now, I remember in 1989 when communism fell and all the smart people at the beginning of 1989 would have bet that communism was going to last a long, long time. But they didn't know. And the reason they didn't know is because people were silent and intimidated, right? And they didn't realize that the system there was really, really hollow, that most people had, in the privacy of their own heads, withdrawn belief, withdrawn legitimacy. They didn't accept the regime's lies anymore. They didn't accept the legitimating lies of the regime. And because they were intimidated by the Stasi, right, they didn't openly say that. And therefore they didn't know that they were the actual majority. Right. But the majority of people had withdrawn inner assent to the regime. And when the power of the regime to intimidate wavered long enough and streets filled up with protesters in Dresden and Leipzig, right, then people realized they were the majority.
Yeah.
And then it unraveled very, very quickly because the people in positions of power didn't have they didn't have the will or the strength of conviction to repress it, right? I think that Germany is in a similar pre-revolutionary state right now. We will not know how far along the road to that kind of change they have gotten until, surprise, the streets fill up with protesters again. But it will happen. I believe it will happen. And I think the same kind of hollowing out of the multicultural regime is happening everywhere in America and Europe and Canada, everywhere there are Europeans. And this horrible system of lies is regnant. People are slowly withdrawing assent from it, and they are being suppressed. Not as thoroughly as the Stasi suppressed it, but still, it's being suppressed. And once the repression breaks down, even momentarily, I think it can all change. And another factor that I think we need to keep in mind is this. The system is working really at, I would say, 99% of its capacity to repress our ideas and our consciousness. And they're acting kind of like it's running hot and they're a little hysterical about this. They're constantly talking about, you know, suppressing fake news, and they're constantly banning Twitter accounts and threatening Google and Facebook and things like that for things that people post in, or Facebook for things posted in Germany. You know, they're getting hysterical. If their capacity to repress us is at, you know, they're working at 99% capacity, it's not going to take a very large leap in our consciousness before their ability to repress it breaks down, right? And when that happens, things can go out of control. It can go viral. It can be like a nuclear reaction, right? And that I think can produce tremendously fast change. And we do have all these social networks, social media, that allow ideas to propagate virally once they're no longer being suppressed. And even while they're being suppressed, we can still get around it. So I really do feel that all the pieces are there, right? All the elements are there for dramatic and radical social change. We just need the catalyst.
Yeah, and we need to organize the pieces.
Yeah, yeah. And the catalysts are being constantly provided. They're, you know, by these,
well, that's the thing.
Muslims, right? For one thing.
Oh, yeah.
In Europe. That's who's providing it. One of these events is going to be enough. One of them will be the straw that breaks the system's back.
That's the thing. I mean, I just said we need to organize the pieces. That, for anyone who's listening who thinks that, for example, the alt-right is some kind of hegemonic, like centralized system, that, you know, we've got organization, and that you could take out one particular part or this, whatever, several parts, and that would be it. That's not what I'm talking about. That's not true anyway, but that's not really what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is group awareness in Germany, in Holland, in France, in Britain, and so on. And that is something that you simply cannot stop because it's coming from within. It's coming from each person. And, there is no stopping it. And in a way, the alt-right is a galvanizing force, maybe a guiding force, but it's not the meat of the thing itself. And it's all inevitable, I think. I don't think it's... you can arrest it. You can, well, in both senses of the word, you can slow it down, but this is inevitable. I mean... I think the white soul has to live. and it will, one way or another.
Yeah, I agree. We don't have a movement where we have a very resilient movement. It is not a top-down organization. It is a bunch of independent little centers of activity connected by the internet, basically.
Well, connected by ideas. And yeah. As time goes by, the more of these centers there will be.
Yeah. And if one center goes silent, others will go live. And I think that that's very good. And so it's not really the kind of thing that can be easily stopped unless they shut down the internet, but they can't do that because it has to shut down world commerce, basically. You know, it's like the ring of power, right? You know, they think that what a great tool this is, but now we can't do without this tool. Our life force is bound to it, right? So they can't throw away the internet. And if they can't throw away the internet, they can't stop us.
Well, exactly, but they also just can't stop the entirety of white people.
They can't stop white people, and they can't stop terrorism either. They can't stop.
Well, I think they're working overtime to stop jihadis, but even then, it's not really doable. I really think they're working, as you say, full capacity. And even then, it still slips through. It still happens. And
yeah.
And then, of course, you come back to the question that I asked earlier. What are we getting out of this? I mean, we're getting a lot of struggle out of it. We're getting a lot, and we're getting the occasional awful attack out of it. But how are we benefiting? And I think that question is becoming really quite obvious to many, many people now. That we suffer. And, you know, okay, I think there's probably a part of the white psyche that wants to suffer as a sort of purgatory, a purgative thing, but not this bloody much. We don't want to lose our continent. And I think that, as I say, that is just becoming clear, a thing that must be addressed. What are we actually getting out of this? I asked the question to people on the internet, and they cannot answer. They don't know what they'll say. We're getting cheap labor out of it. All right, well, that's not a good thing. That's a bad thing. It undermines our own labor. They'll say we get a wide range of restaurants out of it. Fucking big deal. But then the third thing
we can cook our own shawarma. It doesn't take a genius to make that kind of slop. Okay.
And then the third thing they say is that we learn about other cultures. First of all, I don't think that's true. And second, I don't think people are really, that ordinary people are not interested in other culture. I mean, these arguments are just nonsense. There is the phrase post facto rationalizations for something that would never be chosen. So again, this has to be addressed. It has to be acknowledged. And unfortunately, there's no real nice, it's not pleasant. And it's not going to be pleasant, but this is what's been made inevitable. And you know, people, our predecessors have complained about this. The public themselves, the mainstream, have complained about this time and again, and they've been ignored. And I think Trump's arrival, and at another level, the Brexit referendum, are the inevitable reaction to this. And also, just as a closing thing, do you think Le Pen is going to win in France next year?
I don't know. I hope she does. I think this Fillon, is that his name? Looks like a good establishment person to try and suck the life out of the National Front. And that worries me. But if Brexit can happen, then Trump can get elected. And if Trump can get elected, then Le Pen can get elected. I think that all of these things sort of make one another seem more possible and more likely. And so, yeah, I have high hopes for that. I think that would be wonderful. She's already doing quite well in the polls. So unfortunately, what will happen is if she gets into the second round, then all the other parties will suddenly reveal that they really are just different wings of the same establishment, and they'll all vote together.
Oh, well, that's what they did the last time.
Yeah. I honestly think that Marine Le Pen needs to read Submission, the Welbeck book. And I think she needs to start contemplating the possibility that there will have to be a right-wing coup in France to put things on the right course. And France has a long and glorious history of Republican democratic institutions in total gridlock, ruled by utterly pusillanimous apparatchiks, party hacks who are only thinking about themselves, and the common good just drifting and going unminded. And then figures come along and they have revolutions and coups. They put strong men in place, and these strong men try and take care of the common good of France. They've got a long history of that. And so it's not inconceivable in France that the present republic could end with a coup of some sort. And I would, of course, want it to be a rightist coup. So I think about that frequently. That's one of the little things that I, in the back of my mind, I think that could be the direction that France goes. And that the military and security forces in France are pretty right wing. And they're overwhelmingly white. They have not been paused with diversity like the U.S. armed forces have to a huge extent. So these things could happen. It's just something to keep in mind.
Right. Yes, I hope so. Okay, then. Well, let's leave it at that. And I'm getting tired. So.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to start slurring and so on.
Well, I had Sargon and you going on in the background for a long time, and I thought, you know, if I were talking to this guy, I would be totally exhausted. So I thought, you know, woes might be, you know, pretty, what do they say in England, knackered by the time we get started.
Well, I was taking it easy with him, really. I didn't, it started and I thought, let's just be relaxed.
Let him talk.
It's not, we can have arguments throughout the year. I don't want to do it at Christmas.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah. So it turned out quite well.
Good.
Okay. Well.
Well. Merry Christmas to you and to all of your listeners from me at Countercurrents. Then.
Okay.
I really appreciate being able to come on this. This has been a really enjoyable conversation.
It has been. It has been. And thank you for coming on. Okay. Well, that's it for tonight. Thank you to everyone for listening. The next one, hold on a second, let me get the list up. The next one is, it's Henrik Palmgren, tomorrow at 10 p.m. That's 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then we've got Granville Thorndike, and then the last one at midnight is the Wizard of Cos, who is a skeptic. So, okay, thank you, and I guess we'll leave it there. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
See you all later.